Today's show is sponsored by Ting. Go to dancarlin.ting.com and save $25, well, for the month of June, $50 on your first service credit when you sign up with Ting.
Slapping around the ideas until they're black and blue. Dan Carlin, Common Sense.
Obviously, if you've listened to this show for any period of time, you know that, like, well, pretty much any show on politics and current events, there are certain issues that get more attention than others, certain things that are either important to the host or that are sort of connected to whatever the orientation of the program is, things like that. And so one of the things we've obviously talked about a lot on this program has to do with, you know, the system in this country where we elect people to govern and the obvious multifaceted problems associated with, you know, that. And we've hit this from all sorts of angles, and there have been at least a couple of times where one of the ideas that we threw out there, and listen, I never claim that I come up with these things. I imagine, and I was talking to somebody a couple weeks ago who was decidedly of the opinion that as evidence mounts, lots of different people notice the same thing at the same time. So, but we had mentioned in a couple of those programs that, listen, if 20 or 30 years, or maybe 40 years, really 40 years, of trying to figure out how you balance out a political system so that, you know, the will of the people still translates into government policy, you know, through campaign finance reform or all sorts of other things, that maybe this is a lost battle. I mean, when the Supreme Court starts saying things like money is free speech and corporations are people and all these kinds of things. And by the way, for those of you who think that those are truly correct ideas, that's fine too. But what happens if it ends up equaling a corrupt government? Even if you agree with those specific pronouncements, what happens if when all added together and thrown into the soup turns into a corrupt system? And at a certain point, you run out of ways to fix things. And you have to start looking at what you have and say, okay, if these are the rules of the game, even though I disagree with the rules of the game, and even though, you know, for more than 40 years, Americans have been challenging and trying to, you know, alter the rules of the game. But if these are the rules of the game, how do you achieve the goals that you want on that playing field? And I think people have been thinking about this and putting forward ideas and doing experiments for some time on the question, because basically it boils down to an issue like, well, take one that's always important to me, right? Freedom, your freedoms, your constitutional rights, civil liberties, those kinds of things. That's one of my pet peeves. Is this a pet peeve now, Ben? More on how out of touch I am in terms of my standards with the general public, but maybe a pet peeve of mine. And as we know, it's not one of those issues, and a lot of issues are that way, that a lot of people are donating money about. Well, certainly not in the, you know, pro camp. That's part of the problem, too. Sometimes you have people giving money in the anti-camp and nobody giving money in the pro camp. It's like poverty. You don't have tons of billionaires lining up and giving money to candidates, you know, to do something about poverty. So if money is the way the system operates, and what the Supreme Court kind of said on that was, I thought, very intriguing. Their point, basically, they had said, don't come back with any more of this stuff, right? We told you before, this isn't just how the system is operating legally, it's how it was designed to operate. And when they say that, that's when you go, okay, they're saying these are the rules of the game. So how do you play by these rules and get what you want, especially for things that don't have a lot of, you know, big donors and whatnot, if big donors becomes the way the system functions? And we had said, and I've heard other people say this, and you've seen campaigns at very high levels try to do this, where then you start thinking, okay, forget big billionaires. How about we just solicit less money across a broader, you know, range of people, right? If, for example, gay marriage is important to people, and it is, and by the way, on both sides of the issue, right? The pro and the anti. And you are a politician. If a lot of money starts coming forward from either the pro or anti-marriage camp, And it's within your wiggle room, right? A Democrat from San Francisco is probably not going to go anti-gay marriage, no matter how much money comes their way. But if it's within your little range of motion, your wiggle room area, yeah, that money will take you over into that camp. And it'll take you over into the other camp if the money's going that way. And so you start to wonder, okay, Dan, on these issues that are important to you, these civil liberties that don't traditionally have tons of people giving tons of money about, but often have firms, for example, that make money with these machines that help the government surveillance people and blah, blah, blah. There's all sorts of money going into areas where it would be in somebody's interest to trim, you know, some interpretation of a civil liberty somewhere. Not a lot of money going into the general do what you can to protect civil liberties, you know, PAC fund or super PAC. So I mention this because since the last program we did, a whole bunch of NSA, Patriot Act type stuff was in the news. And I'm not going to go too deeply into it because I, of course, found something totally different, interesting about it. Ostensibly, on the surface, this was a historic pushback against government spying, the biggest since the 1970s, a couple articles that I read said. And Rand Paul got up there and delayed the, you know, Patriot Act being renewed or delayed the, you know, the voting on a USA Freedom Act that would have blah, 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 blah. And of course, you know, lots of news stories generated about his grandstanding. A lot of people saying things like, well, he got up there and said something like, you know, and I don't remember the exact words, but it was something like, you know, if you approve of this or this freedom message or whatever it was, give $5, you know, to Rand Paul for president or whatever it was. It was something like that. A solicitation for donations, right? And basically saying, if you like what I'm saying up here, you know, it wouldn't have been out of place at all had it been a U.S. politician talking about one of the issues that is often, you know, highlighted. If it was a Second Amendment proponent, you know, a Texas Republican going, and remember who stood up for your Second Amendment rights, donate $5 to Rick Perry for president. Nobody would have blinked. Same thing if it had been, you know, a liberal talking about, you know, I stood up for working people. Don't forget about that, you know, at the ballot box or when you're donating. Things that, it, you know, this is all politics 101, right? So it was kind of funny to watch everybody from liberal commentators to Republican hawks slam Paul for doing essentially the same thing they all do all the time, but doing it for a cause they don't normally do it for. Because he was saying something to the effect of, you know, donate to me, I'm the guy who'll get up here and protect your liberty, everybody kind of freaked out in a way that they wouldn't have. John McCain said something to the effect of, I see what's going on here, you know, meaning, oh, this is dirty politics and putting our country at risk. And you're thinking, I've seen John McCain do that a million times. He just does them on all these issues that we're used to seeing politicians get up there and, you know, essentially say, I can't be here if you don't pay for my campaign, and here's what I'll do for you. And I guess what I'm saying is, if the Supreme Court is right and that this is our system functioning the way it's supposed to function, and candidates and politicians who, you know, give you what you say you want, and then you reward them with helping them get reelected, if that's the way this system is supposed to work, and money is the vehicle for doing this, right? It's what makes this all happen. It's the transaction, you know, method. Then isn't Rand Paul kind of doing exactly what many of us have speculated for a long time ought to be done on these issues that don't have giant billionaires out there who have oftentimes a vested financial interest in supporting what they support? Isn't this what we talked about, you know, wanting to see more experimentation with? If we are in a corrupt system here and money talks, why can't money talk for the causes that are important for us? We may not have as many billionaires on our side, but we may. But we have a lot more people. And just so you know, when I thought about this, I thought I had a little maybe extra expertise over your average Joe Q public person on this. There's, you know, the vast majority of people who actually do this know more than I do, but I probably know more than, you know, man on the street interviews would indicate the public knows, because that's kind of how we pay the bills around here, right? You know the deal. Nobody gives a ton of cash to us, but, you know, a certain percentage of the listeners donate. Sometimes we get $1, sometimes we get $3, $10, you know, $25. And, you know, this happens, and everybody is shocked, by the way, that this does happen. much easier for them, and this has been suggested to us many times, that we sell stock or we get a big investor, or that, and we never did any of that, and we think it's working better the way it is, and we don't really owe any single person anything. But we owe the audience something. If this can work at this small scale, it can work anywhere, I would think. And if we're going to have a system that is based on money getting you your policy goals put forward, any chance we have of getting the policy goals we want put forward is going to have to be backed by money too. Do you think that this the business model that podcasters and a lot of other artists and creators out there are seeing work for them, the one that we use, do you think that's indicative of a change, a generational change, a digital age era change, where the public is willing to support things like that? In a funny way, and I hate to admit this because I'm against what the court said on you know, how the system is supposed to function, but in a funny way, you could almost see the evolution of the digital space. How's that for a good corporate word or something? The evolution of the digital space almost like curve around this system we've created to sort of mesh with it. If, you know, we always talked about online voting or the ability for the public to weigh in on policy issues online, because we now have the online ability, but we also have the online ability to click on PayPal or some other payment system and say, you know what, like that speech by Rand Paul I just heard, boom, $3 to him right there. Make more speeches like that, Rand Paul, and there's more $3 contributions where that came from. You know, the wonderful thing about buying into ideas like that, the playing along with the corruption idea, is that it doesn't seem so far-fetched. I mean, what makes it hard to go against the corruption idea is the knowledge we all have of certain benchmark realities, like, you know, the human nature involved in greed and the way money tends to have so much power and all these kinds of things. And it makes these struggles daunting, and you feel like Don Quixote up there, you know, tilting at windmills, right? But all of a sudden, if you can arrange for a plan or an approach that takes advantage of those same things that the windmill is using against Don Quixote, all of a sudden it doesn't sound as far-fetched. You're thinking to yourself, I could probably buy a candidate for liberty. I could probably buy a candidate who's going to have a more humble foreign policy. I could probably, in other words, once you start talking about the possibility of buying candidates, why, change seems likely, doesn't it? In a funny way, it's a more direct way than trying to convince a candidate. I mean, Rand Paul getting up there and saying, give me $5 or whatever, if you like what I said here in this speech, or if you want to defend civil liberties or whatever, I think the politicians are just mad that he's using that on a new issue, because they can't possibly be mad at the general strategy, because they do it all the time. Are we insinuating that Rand Paul, did I call him Ron Paul a few times? It wouldn't surprise me if I did that, Bob. I mean, Ben. So to suggest that Rand Paul invented the pandering to the electorate, well, I mean, that would be giving him way too much credit, wouldn't it? I guess my point is that, you know, I sort of have mood swings from manically excited about hopeful change, where I think I see sort of path to reform opening up, and you think, oh, boy, I could run right through that hole and score a touchdown and get some reform, to swinging to the totally opposite extreme, where I just feel like we're doomed, and boy, the windmill looks so strong, and this lance of mine is so thin and flexible, you know. When I look at the idea of co-opting money for purposes that the public agrees with, or often agrees with, I should say, in Iowa, I saw some conversation because the candidates are all starting to hang out in Iowa because that's where the Iowa caucus is going to be. I saw some statements by the public that just make your hair stand on end in terms of their attitudes towards liberty and all these kinds of things. So maybe I should take it back. I guess what I'm saying is, I can imagine if Rand Paul were successful and a bunch of people gave him money because he was doing speeches where he talked about, we need to make sure we keep some of our civil liberties and make sure the government has limits on what it can do. If he made a bunch of money off that, don't you think that the free market sort of approach would dictate that now you'd have a bunch of imitators showing up? The first thing that happens is you'd see a bunch of people who are already politicians in Washington who are looking for a way to jumpstart fundraising, who would all of a sudden discover the issues that Rand Paul was making money off of. And you'd also get a bunch of people at the lower levels who would say, listen, either that's how I always feel and now I can make money doing it and get elected, or I don't care what I feel, that's a good way to make money, I'll push that. It's kind of hard, isn't it, to make a distinction between a politician who touts the issues you care about but really doesn't believe it, and a politician who touts the issues you care about and does believe it? As long as they do what you paid them to do, do you care what they really believe? I mean, if you're one of these giant outside special interests and you essentially buy and pay for some of these legislators and they vote the way you wanted them to vote, but they don't really believe it, does that bother you at all? It goes without saying that the American people can raise a lot of money in tiny little amounts. I mean, $3 a person if they want to. And I think you've seen some of the power in little teeny ways flexed so far, and everybody's already made it proverbial, but the Stop Online Piracy Act reaction from the general public, to some degree the net neutrality debate. I mean, when the public gets their hackles up, they don't go out in the street like they used to in the 60s, but they do go online. And if 5 million of them give $3 a piece, all of a sudden they are a force to be reckoned with. That is an amount of money that competes with major corporations and huge donors. Think about what the public could buy in terms of, shall we just call it representation? That doesn't sound very corrupt. Think about what the public could buy in representation and policy advocation for that kind of money, right? I was never a math major, but 5 million people given $3 sounds like about $15 million. $15 million in the U.S. political system can get things done. Could the public buy more candidates than the special interest? And I say special interest because we all know that there are ones that are more prone to giving money to Republicans, ones that are more prone to giving money to Democrats. Take them all together, though. They represent, you know, the lobbyists and the outside groups. All these people, by the way, just playing by the rules. This is the way the system is set up. I'm not blaming them. I'm just suggesting something that others have suggested, too, that if these are the rules, that the public can buy damn good and expensive lobbyists, too. We ought to be able to buy some legislators. I think Rand Paul making it obvious. See, it's one thing, I think, to go to some of the special interests and say, I'll protect your gun rights, NRA, so make sure your members give me some money. It's another thing to go straight to the people. It's almost like, hey, we had a deal. You don't go straight to the people for the money. That's pandering. Pandering for Liberty. Maybe we'll call this show Pandering for Liberty, or the Freedom Pack. And by the way, it was funny. I was reading these stories about Rand Paul when I was thinking about this topic and then this whole spotlight thing he put himself into. And I stumbled upon, I think it was Salon Magazine Online had a piece where they showed, I think it was an actual like fundraising ad for his Liberty Pack or whatever it's called, right? He's got some related, is it related, Ben, or are they not allowed to have any contact? It doesn't matter. I mean, it's one of these things that's a fundraising ad, right? And you're used to seeing them. You can take whole classes in college that show you the history of fundraising ads. And it's actually very interesting stuff because you can see how Madison Avenue and all these ad companies are trying to create a 30-second piece of propaganda to touch certain human buttons inside you. I mean, it's rather sophisticated stuff. But this Paul ad, America's Liberty, I'm looking at it now. America's Liberty is what the pack is called. But this America's Liberty campaign ad is anything but sophisticated on the surface. I mean, when you watch it, I was reminded, it reminded me after I got done with it, and I watched the whole thing, so it's about like 30 seconds, which is part of the genius too. I mean, you know, we're taking advantage of short attention spans, as Madison Avenue has understood you do with campaign ads forever, right? You're trying to touch certain buttons. This ad is hilarious. And for 30 seconds, you think it's a joke. And then you think it's the stupidest thing you ever saw. And then by the end of the piece, I let it sink in for about 10 seconds. And it took me about 10 seconds to realize maybe it's like genius instead. I had the same reaction to that, the Korean musician who did the Gangnam Style video. I saw it Someone showed it to me before it broke big in the United States. So I went in with a totally clean mental slate, not knowing what to expect at all, turned it on and had the exact same reaction. At first, I was like, this has got to be a joke. You know, about a third of the way through it. Second third of the way, I thought, this is so ridiculous. This is hilariously bad. Do these people know how awful this is? And then by the last third, I'm realizing, no. This is a piece of genius. This is a piece of art. And it's, you know, the old line that it's so bad, it's good. I don't think that applies to the Gangnam Style thing, but it does apply to the America's Liberty ad. It's so bad, it's good. And you think about who their target audience is, and you look at it, and you think you can almost hear in the tone of the voice of the guy narrating it or whatever, the tongue-in-cheek attitude of it. And if it was done tongue-in-cheek, again, it's almost a genius kind of marketing totally directed at millennials, maybe Generation X people, but something that absolutely my mother would look at and go, huh? But my mother is in the age demographic where you expect a lot of Republicans, right? So who's Rand Paul marketing this stuff towards? Like I said, I mean, you have to, when you go watch it, you just think to yourself, I don't even know what to decide about this. But if it's deliberate and tongue-in-cheek and the whole thing, it's genius. It's 21st century, you know, and you would have to say second decade of the 21st century campaign ads for the under 40 crowd. And it's fascinating. And I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, now that the Supreme Court has really basically shut the door to making changes to the way money impacts the system. And as I said, gone so far as to say what we think is a bug is instead an original feature in the design of the American political system. Okay, so if that's the case, how do you play to win on these issues that traditionally have a harder time finding, you know, conduits to money? It should be pointed out, too, the basic fundamental differences in the assumptions we're playing with in a show like this one than we did when we did a show like Kickstarting the Revolution 10 episodes ago. You know, a lot of people, by the way, are pursuing some of the ideas we talked about in Kickstarting the Revolution. That was about using the internet as a fundraising tool to help finance the campaigns of outsiders who are not politicians, who are daunted by the fundraising needs and all that, but who might go and serve if that wasn't a big deal, hard, you know, burden to overcome. And maybe, you know, the people, in a very similar way to what we talked about in this episode, could come up with the money, give them the money, they go to Washington, D.C., you get enough of them, and then they work to fix the broken, corrupt system. Bingo. You see a lot of people talking about ways to do that. There are PACs that have been formed designed to elect people that will go and work on campaign finance reform type things, right? To restructure and rebalance it and even things out a little bit in terms of the power of the electorate and special interests. But the problem is now, you know, you wouldn't really be taking the Supreme Court at their word here. And I still see a lot of people whose goal is to fight what the court has ruled recently. But if you assume that you're not going to get a 180-degree flip-flop anytime soon, what that means is that anybody you manage to, through tons of labor and expended effort and lost opportunity costs and all that, what you manage to do is send a bunch of people to Washington who can't change a broken system because the highest court in the land says it isn't broken. So what do you do if you decide you've lost on that? That's what this show's about. This is about examining the other side of a coin. What do you do? What's plan B? If you've lost, how do you compensate for that? How do you buy in to the corrupt system? If certain policy outcomes are important to you, and there seems to be no chance of having a clean system anytime soon that you can wage a fair fight in and get what you want in a free democratic system, how can you get involved in the game to maximize your chances of having the outcomes you deem important? In an era where these legislators are like products, it seems to me what the court is saying is anyone, you included, are free to buy one. It is a less idealistic, less clean-feeling idea than the one we proposed in Kickstarting the Revolution, but it might be a more realistic one. I don't think I'm ready to give up on idealistic outcomes myself yet, but I'm one of those people that always likes to have a backup plan and a plan B about what you do if the best case scenario doesn't come to pass. In any case, if this is all about buying candidates, then I think the Rand Paul moment, if we can call it that, which other people were focusing on the NSA reform, which we'll get to in a second, was really a Rand Paul moment for something different. The moment where we saw so far the best example of somebody essentially saying, I will represent your interests on this particular issue, but you have to give me money to do that. There's something about making it that open that appeals to me. It takes some of the seediness away, I guess. People call this legalized bribery in our system right now. Well, okay, if instead we talk about it as the commodification, the turning of candidates into commodities, where essentially they're like attorneys. Shall we compare them to attorneys, where you go to an attorney and you say, listen, I need you to do some work for me and here's some money. Okay, they represent you. That's what these guys are anyway, most of them attorneys. Paul's not an attorney. He's an eye doctor, I think. But most of these guys come from a law background. That's essentially what we're doing here, is we're saying it should not just be the prerogative of the rich or the corporations or the special interests to purchase their candidate. We can buy candidates too. And if we work together, we can buy more candidates than they can. Paul is appealing directly to the public. I think we should start buying ourselves some candidates and watch maybe the direction of Washington change, because it will be following the money. I think that gives us a much better chance of competing with the money than trying to do so from the outside. And, you know, as people always said in the campaign finance reform, you know, battle, you're never going to get the money out of politics. It will always find a way. And one of the ways, by the way, it can find, and we see this all the time in Washington, is the revolving door between government and private industry, where somebody will be a congressman or a senator and serve on some financial regulatory commission, and then all of a sudden, the minute they leave government, they walk right into a Wall Street firm and start working for them at some amazing salary. Pretty hard to stop, you know, the practice of going to one of these people who sits on one of these committees and saying, listen, you just treat us extra fair and there'll be a job waiting for you when you get out. How do you stop that? So if money's always going to find its way into the hands of the people that are looking for it, maybe we could start putting money into the hands of the people that are looking for it, because they will tout our interest and what's important to us if they do. And you can think of a whole range of issues, can't you? I mean, if all of a sudden 5 million Americans decided it was really important to them that fighting poverty became a priority of government, and all of a sudden raised $15 million to make it the priority of some of our elected officials, don't you think that would be an interesting change in the way the structure of government has been used so far, taking advantage of the fact that money in politics is a right? Well, it can be our right, too. And I think this Paul thing is just the latest example. Let's not forget, by the way, wasn't it President Obama the first time that he ran for president that he was soliciting all those tiny donations from people? Other people have done this. There are just sort of benchmark moments, though, in the history of perhaps this practice. And maybe this Rand Paul thing is another one of those. Now, for those who want me to talk about the actual issue as opposed to this weird little sidebar thing I noticed, I'll get into that for a minute, but I'm going to disappoint you. The reason Paul is in the news right now so much, because you may be getting the show in a couple of months and not know, it's not that I'm fixated on Paul, but he stood up in front of the Senate and sort of used filibuster-style tactics to prevent what probably would have been just a blanket renewal of the Patriot Act, because that's happened already before, but he was able to sort of prevent that, and then something called the USA Freedom Act was passed instead, which I guess Paul was against also. But it was something that's being hailed by a lot of people as this now wonderful pushback for civil liberties against government overreach, and that it will strike the wonderful, you know, perfect balance. I saw a very pro-President Obama article today that said it's this wonderful, I mean, he's come in here and he's fixed this program and he's provided this wonderful protection for the American people. It was his press secretary secretary they kept quoting, so no wonder it was so historic. And I mean, this is the program, by the way, that had only had this happen to it because Edward Snowden made us aware that it was happening, which made the president angry. I mean, there's no way they wanted to get here, because they could have gotten here without any of this. They were forced into this. And the reason a lot of you are going to be disappointed with me is because I don't think this is anything. This is sort of window dressing. This is feel-good stuff. This is, you know, people will argue, well, this is a real reform, Dan, and this is a real reform. There's not a single person out there that I could talk to in the listening audience who's read significantly on the history of U.S. intelligence operations, who's going to think that the general public and maybe even the senators and congressmen have any real control over how those people decide to do their jobs. I think you could have a very good argument about whether or not they should. I mean, we talk about specialists all the time, and a lot of times people will say, well, listen, I don't want to have, some hamburger flipper doing my brain surgery, right? Implying that, listen, for certain things, the expertise of the person involved is very important. There's a reason you only put people who are experts in jobs like that, right? The average Joe on the street is not prepared to do that kind of work. I've heard people make that same sort of comment about intelligence agencies. That to have the general public deciding what the rules should be for an intelligence agency when they've never worked in intelligence, they haven't seen the secret stuff, they don't know what's going on out there. This argument's made a lot. And, you know, if you compare it to brain surgery, there's something where you can say, I can kind of see their point. But, you know, I'm a walk a mile in the other guy's moccasins kind of guy, and I always try to do that. At the same time, I would suggest that when you leave it to the intelligence services to make these decisions for themselves, they constantly do things that, when exposed, people are mad about. In a lot of these articles, you'll see people saying things like, this is the biggest pushback against a surveillance overreach since the 1970s. Well, what they're really talking about are hearings that we've mentioned on this program many times. They're very famous, especially those of you who pay attention to the history of intelligence services in the U.S. are very aware. The famous Church and Pike Committee hearings. If you actually go and, like, see video of these or go watch a history of them or read a book that contains a lot of information about them, you can't even imagine us doing anything like that today. It is a full-on open expose. The one real time in U.S. history where the curtain was drawn back and a significant amount of how the intelligence agencies operate was made public. The head of the CIA at the time gave up what were referred to as the crown jewels and was never forgiven inside the agency for doing that. But at the same time, it's incidents like that that remind you that even though Dan Carlin might not be an intelligence expert or Joe Smith or Jane Doe, none of us might be intelligence experts, but we can say, listen, we don't care what you do, but we think, for example, torturing suspects or assassinating foreign leaders is wrong. Now, history shows that sometimes, you know, the general public trying to write these rules has an effect, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes the intelligence services do whatever they want to do and hide it all under a cloak of secrecy, and then when it comes out due to some leaker or something years later, they'll say, mistakes were made, that director has been out of office for 2 terms now, we're investigating internally. There's all kinds of ways to go back and just say, whoops, years later. On the other hand, it can prove to be a political embarrassment sometimes. Those Church and Pike Committee hearings that we mentioned a second ago were part of a real reform era that came out of Watergate and the Vietnam era and the investigations into public figures, including entertainment people in the early 70s and late 1960s. And in that reform-minded atmosphere, all sorts of rules were passed. For example, President Gerald Ford passed a rule that says, you know, the intelligence agencies of the U.S. wouldn't be involved in advocating or training people in political assassinations. And maybe you think to yourself, oh, it's a feel-good thing. Or at least it sets a line in the sand beyond which, you know, we may not be experts, we in the general public, but Americans agree that this conflicts with our national values. And then in 1984, the Reagan administration had a huge problem when A story broke in the middle of his 1984 re-election campaign against Walter Mondale. It became a big issue in the debates and whatnot, that there was a CIA manual that, you know, advocated or taught assassination techniques of, you know, for example, in Nicaragua, going after the Marxist Sandinista regime, and assassination was shown as one of the potential tools that can be used. And it was a big embarrassment. It wasn't an embarrassment because the administration perhaps had a huge problem with this. They may have, they may not. The intelligence agencies obviously weren't that upset with the idea, but it was embarrassing in front of a public that the government and everybody seemed to think had the right to set maximum standards. I think after 9/11, that rule got lessened a little bit. But even so, you see the pushback against things like torture, where public opinion may not be specialized expert opinion. We may not be the doctors in the operating room, but if you start sawing off limbs during an appendectomy, we may say, wait a minute, I'm no expert, but that's wrong. I think the first thing worth noticing when you're trying to evaluate what this did to intelligence gathering capabilities or to civil liberties, you have to realize that there's some theater going on in Washington where the fear tactics have to be employed, and everyone has to talk about, you know, if you're defending this sort of stuff, that these are key tools and that people will die if they're not used. But let's remember something. If you read, you know, deeply into these stories, the metadata tool was something that the intelligence services themselves were thinking about ditching, in part because they weren't as effective in reality as it was hoped they were going to be, and in part because they have methods that do the same thing better. There's some redundancy to some of these things. We're busy focusing on the cutting-edge technology, you know, that was in use once the 9/11 attacks happened. These people are a decade ahead of that. They don't mind getting rid of the old programs, especially if it makes us feel like there's been some victory and some pushback. And like some of these articles said, the biggest pushback since the 1970s. I was reading one columnist today, and you just kind of laugh. He said, for the first time in years, I picked up my phone this morning knowing that there wasn't any intelligence operatives knowing what I was doing. And you just think to yourself, are you really so naive? One of the things I like about some of the stuff Rand Paul is saying, and we're going to love some of the stuff Bernie Sanders is saying, the only reason to watch these primary debates that are going to happen with the Democrats and the Republicans is to watch, if you'll pardon the pun, the bomb throwers in both those parties lob these hand grenades into what otherwise would be a very status quo, genteel conversation amongst sincere and respectful colleagues, and bring up the kind of stuff that make everybody sweat. If you don't have Rand Paul in the Republican primary debates and you don't have Bernie Sanders in the Democratic one, there's going to be a nice, polite disagreement over the traditional battlegrounds, and where both sides agree this is a fair place to fight over issues, but when my dear colleague and I begin to talk about national security, that's where we close ranks. You know, I mean, you get that kind of talk. But Rand Paul will come in there and start talking about, you know, how U.S. efforts in the Middle East helped create the kind of conditions that are so troublesome now, and people will freak out, but that'll be fun to watch. And Bernie Sanders will come in and start talking about Wall Street in a way that exposes the fact that Hillary Clinton, among others, is deeply tied to them and might be severely constrained from doing a whole lot against their interest if push came to shove. Without those two guys in the debates, we're just, you know, it wouldn't be worth watching. Here's to hoping that all kinds of heck breaks loose in both of those debates, and we get a chance to see these candidates have to answer questions that, one, they haven't prepared for weeks figuring out the best focus group answer, and two, that they normally don't have to address at all. Paul brought up, or alluded to, he didn't outright say it, but it's so important that someone did. Again, this is, you know, people get the idea sometimes, Dan Carlin's a big Rand Paul supporter. No, I'm in favor of all these people that come up and bring up the real issues, and who don't talk about the safe subjects that our politicians normally deal with while they're avoiding icebergs that loom in front of our ship of state, right? I'll tell you something that I do all the time, and I know many of you do too. I love reading books. Sorry, this is a little tangent, but I love reading books from the far left, and I mean like the Marxist bomb-throwing left sometimes, but certainly the old-line Marxist left, and from the far right. And we get in trouble sometimes. I mean, I remember when we had Pat Buchanan on this program, And, you know, he came on and he was great, by the way, at a time period where nobody knew what podcasts were, didn't know who we were. This guy consented to come on the program. We were talking about his book and some ideas, you know, where we agree, this more humble foreign policy idea. So, you know, we didn't get into the things we all disagree with, but we had a great time. He was open. He was honest. He was articulate. There was a lot of good give and take. And I got slammed by a lot of people afterwards. How could you have right-wing Pat Buchanan on? And, you know, it's the same thing with when I read these left-wing guys. Here's what I like about all of them. I love their diagnoses of problems. I love seeing how a guy like Tariq Ali diagrams problems in books like The Extreme Center. And he's a leftist guy. But I love reading Pat Buchanan stuff on how he diagrams problems with the United States that's going from a republic to an empire. Where I differ with those people are in the solutions, oftentimes. And sometimes we differ in figuring out what needs to be addressed. But I think sometimes they're critiques and they're figuring out of the core seed of a lot of problems are right on point. So when people say things like, I hear Dan's a big Bernie Sanders supporter, or I hear Dan's a big Rand Paul supporter, I'm an outsider supporter. I'm supporting any of these people who come in and talk about the elephant in the living room problems, right? Which sober, careful politicians who know what they're doing avoid, right? Rand Paul the other day alluded to the doomsday device that we talk about on this program periodically. It is absolutely, in my opinion, the most scary, stupid thing this country, maybe this world, is doing right now. Isn't that funny? With all the massive things you could put into that category, the fact that we have a doomsday device that has evolved due to trends and forces and that is staring us right in the face and that we aren't dealing with at all. Paul alluded to it the other day. He didn't come right out and say it. And he's taking some flack, by the way, for saying it, for even alluding to it. But folks, let me set it up for you. How about this? Let's set it up a little bit. And my apologies to anyone that this might traumatize. I don't think I'm giving ideas to any bad guys when I say this either. I imagine this has been on the list for some time as a possible way we could create horrible carnage and damage the political systems of the West and all these kinds of things, make them appear even more hypocritical. Ladies and gentlemen, what if somebody did what they did on 9/11, flying airplanes into buildings, but instead of going after, you know, tall skyscrapers or whatnot, they simply flew a plane into an arena that was holding a major sporting event. A massive gathering of people in one place and you crash a plane into it. Okay? Imagine that day. Let's just throw 20,000 dead and tons wounded as our numbers to plug in for X. Ladies and gentlemen, what happens after that? What happens after that? As we've said before, this is something you need to be working on now to insulate yourself from the way we're going to behave, you know, after some terrible tragedy, which we're told is inevitable. Ought to have a cooling off period where we can't destroy the Constitution 5 minutes after the next attack. Anyway, we've done whole shows on that. The point is that unless you address the fact that that dynamic is there and visible right in front of all of us, you can't do anything about it. You're happily walking, you know, off the cliff here, knowing that there's a cliff in the distance. I can tell you that all this talk about limits on the ability of, for example, the government to do anything that they need to do to prevent another one of those, they go out the window the next day. And we begin to ratchet things down from where we are now. Where we are now has been a multi-year process of ratcheting down from where we were in terms of civil liberties, balancing out government authority in 2001. Imagine a similar amount of ratcheting, but starting here. That is some dystopian future right there, folks. And it's funny, this isn't speculative at all. And Paul had made some comments about his opponents are just hoping for I'm paraphrasing, my apologies to everybody, but something like, you know, my opponents are just hoping for another terror attack so that they can, you know, come back at me for this. But that's a sort of symptom of what the entire thing would be. You know, the dynamic that we have going on is so based on fear, but it's based on fear from the people on the governmental side of things that's a little different from our fear. And I think you have to recognize it because there are human beings in this story. And, you know, my policy is always to try to think of how it is on the other guy's shoes, right? In the case of, think about the guys who run the CIA or the NSA, right? Their biggest fear absolutely has to be screwing up, somehow missing that plan for the plane to fly into that stadium full of football fans. That's their biggest nightmare. And it's their biggest nightmare for a couple of reasons. One, they're human beings who care about human life and they don't want to see anybody get hurt. Two, they're human beings and they have a job and they're tasked with the duty and responsibility of preventing that and they missed it somehow. In other words, they're paranoid that they're going to make a mistake here. They don't want to take any chances. All their incentives are, oh my God, give me every tool I have to see that that doesn't happen, right? And I've often said, by the way, folks, great states are always paranoid. Always. When you take a US, China, Russia, Great Britain, Japan, they're all paranoid. But they have a reason to be. What's that old line, Ben? It's not really paranoia if they are out to get you. Well, all these states have people out to get them. Just look at the hacking that they deal with every day on a very mild side of things, I guess you could say, although one of these days it might not be so mild. But from the hacking to the people flying planes into your buildings, these governments are all paranoid, but people really are out to get them. The problem is that the people who are paranoid are also the ones who have to decide, you know, that going this much farther than where we are now is too far. It's hard for people who are scared to death of making a mistake here to find logical dividing lines between where their power should go and where it shouldn't. How do you tell somebody who's absolutely petrified about somebody breaking into their house that two locks on the door is enough? You don't have to do three. I mean, the natural inclination is to say, I'll tell you what I'm going to do, 10 locks, and I'm going to push the armoire behind the door too. And I'm going to hold a shotgun on the door all night. I mean, there's no natural boundary where somebody in the position of authority and responsibility in this case is going to go, you know what, if there was a terrorist attack tomorrow, I would feel okay because I would know we had done everything you could possibly do. This is where you get into the arguments too about torturing people. You know, where there are people who are just absolutely petrified that they will somehow screw up and a terrorist attack will happen that could have been prevented if only we'd used every tool at our disposal. The problem is every tool at our disposal will quickly take us into areas that the public isn't comfortable with. And then we get right back around to where we kind of started, where we were saying, should the public's comfort level impact the way intelligence operations occur at all? Well, there's two sides to this. I happen to come down on the same side on both of them, but let's recognize that there's two sides. One is what we do to outsiders, and one is what we do to ourselves. If the American people are confronted with another big terror attack, and then we find out that, you know, we said the gloves are off part two, we go and we start torturing people we capture in the Middle East, and that program starts, there are going to be people that say, you know, we have to do whatever we have to do. Do you want another terror attack? Who would not say that if we were torturing people here in the United States to find out, you know, where their drug connection was? This is how we see, by the way, the laws always devolve, right? I mean, the majority of times the Patriot Act gets employed has nothing to do with terrorism. It's used in drug crimes far more. Legal creep is a natural, understood, and expected part of our system. So even when these, you know, agencies say, you know what, I'm so petrified of a plane being flown into a coliseum that I will do these things I would never do otherwise just to be on the safe side. The problem is 10 years later, we're doing those things for far less important situations. Very rarely do laws avoid creeping over into areas where they're being used in ways that were never intended at the time they were passed. This is what makes extraordinary laws so extra dangerous. And we do this periodically in the U.S. We pass some law to deal with some extraordinary problem, right? The regular laws don't work for it. The mafia, regular laws don't apply. We'll pass this special law. It's going to go after the mafia. It's targeted toward the mafia. And then you notice down the road, some prosecutor in some locality will say, you know, I bet I could get these guys on charges, you know, that we usually go after the mafia with. And then he tries it and boom, 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 you start to build a whole legal rationale. And 20 years later, you're using that extraordinary law to go after the extraordinary situation that the mafia posed against everyone, abortion protesters. So you have to be aware that those things happen. But it's not the job of the people on the intelligence side of things to worry about that. They're petrified that they're going to screw up and a terror attack is going to get through. It's not in their best interest to sit there and go, look, I got to carve out some room for the American public's privacy here. And it's so important that I'd be okay with the next terror attack if I didn't read all their records, when right now I could read all their records. It's the same dynamic you watch with our senators and congressmen, too, where they are, you know, petrified that there'll be another terror attack and their political opponents will be able to say, my opponent voted against, you know, the extraordinary Patriot Act powers, and now you see what happens. This is what complacency and weakness and being soft on terrorism does. I mean, that's the way our system is set up, right? So, you know, in the same way that doctors sometimes practice what's called defensive medicine, and journalists do defensive journalism, you know, as ways to cover your rear end and make sure that that maybe this patient doesn't need this extra cancer test. But if they had cancer and I didn't find it, I might get sued. So damn the torpedoes. I don't care what it costs. I don't care that they're probably not likely to even get cancer. I'm doing the test so I don't get sued. There are people in government who are our legislators who sit there and go, I'm voting for this, you know, ratcheting up of anti-terror laws because I'm afraid I'd be exposed if I didn't and there were another terror attack. That's a dynamic, folks, that encourages restriction, right? Same thing that the intelligence people have and the people at the NSA. Their concern is protecting us. It's hard for them to weigh where the line should be, where they stop protecting us because it violates civil liberties. And I've heard people who are in these agencies say to me, one of them said straight up, and you hear it all the time, Dan, if your child is in that stadium where the plane, you know, runs into, you're going to have wanted me to do everything to stop that. And that's exactly right. But folks, if you base a country's civil liberties policy based on what you would want the authorities to do if your child's life was threatened, we're going straight to Godwin's law right now. You'll have a fascist regime that's designed on, you know, the attitudes of parents whose children have been abducted. I guess this takes us sort of all the way in a circle, though, because while we can't expect the intelligence people to easily know how to, you know, dial back the carrots and sticks, the incentives and disincentives that are working on them all the time. And just as we can't really expect our legislators to easily say, listen, I'm going to insulate myself so when the next terror attack happens, I'm not to blame. Maybe we can begin to, you know, have our priorities noticed because we are using the same technique that everyone who's having their priorities noticed is using. And, you know, that oftentimes when I'll talk about lobbying, there will people who will say things like, well, this is a wonderful group, Dan, out there, and they have to lobby too. That's the way the game is played. I understand that. I think what the milestone that Rand Paul was involved with the other night, where he essentially did his little liberty thing and stood up here and then said, and if you like what I'm doing, you know, send $5 to, I think that's an example of us finding the way to work this system for populist causes and group causes, things that are public, right? The freedoms and the constitutional protections we have, that's a public shared trust, right? We all have an interest in that. Some of these special interests are special interests because they advocate for segments of the corporate world or segments of the private world. Or segments of the public world sometimes. We have public employee unions that band together and give money to push their causes. But something like your right to not live in an Orwellian dystopian future where you are exposed to everyone else's view, or at least the government's view and private industry's view at all times, we all have an interest in preventing that outcome. If the politicians are only interested in what's donating to their campaigns, then maybe we're beginning to see the development of the, you know, post corporations are people, post money is free speech Supreme Court decisions, the new landscape and the beginning of a codification of rules for how the game is played for the people that haven't really been playing it, you know, by the modern rules for very long. The reason these politicians are sneering at Rand Paul isn't because he's up there, you know, saying, I protected this and I did this for you, so give me money. It's because he's doing it about things that people don't normally use as a fundraising tool. When somebody gets up there and says, donate to me and I'll protect your civil liberties, or donate to me and I'll advocate for your privacy, and all these kinds of things. They may be very much like a lawyer, a hired gun doing your bidding, but if that's the way the game is played, do you really want to be the only people out there whose cause doesn't have a hired gun out there working for them? I think what we saw over the last couple of days is some of the old line politicians, John McCain and Lindsey Graham, stand out as perfect examples, who are actually showing a little bit of fear in the face of what we might call the freedom lobby. We've been telling you about Ting on this program for some time, mobile service made easy. And in the same way it's good and fun and rewarding to watch good things happen to good people, it's fun to watch good companies doing well. In Ting's case, I love watching a company that's number one, you know, goal is customer service do well. And you can tell Ting's doing well because they've added a second network to their capabilities. Now they can use about 80% of the cell phones in circulation, including iPhone 6 and iPhone 6 Plus, as part of the Ting service. If you want to save money on your bill, I would definitely contact Ting, because from all the people we've heard from, only one said that he couldn't save money, but that when Ting ran his bill and looked at how he uses his phone, they told him that they couldn't save him money, and he said that made him want to sign up with Ting. So you'll probably save some money. And if you do sign up with Ting in the month of June, they're doubling their service credit that they normally give to new customers from $25 to $50. So it might be a good time, if you've been thinking about it, to not procrastinate and begin, you know, checking out why they're doing well. I mean, no hold customer support if you were to ever have a problem, a powerful online management tool that would probably keep you from having to call, a customer service oriented, you know, slew of options that would probably keep you from becoming upset in the first place. No contracts. If you became upset, you can get out of it. If you're locked into somebody else's contract, Ting usually will help you get out of that. You could have unlimited devices on one plan. You only pay for the time you use. No overage charges or penalties. You get the picture now. It's a customer service oriented business, and I'm always in favor of that. If you go to dancarlin.ting.com right now, you can get not the normal $25, but $50 off your first service credit or device discount when you sign up with Ting.
If you are not already following us on Twitter, please do so. The address is @DC Common Sense.
Hey, are you feeling guilty yet? Come on, a buck a show. That's all we ask.
Go to dancarlin.com for information on how to donate to the show.